If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
Hello, my name is Bea, and I'm camping in Union, Illinois. You're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It is great to be here with you today. This is show number 858. What we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer in the studio today, so good morning to Mr. Ferguson. We love him. And again, thank you for listening to this program. A quick update on something that I discussed back in October of 2022 here on this program with good friend of this show, Mick Dumpke, who is a local investigative reporter, and he's really one of the best that we have here in Chicago. We talked about here on the show about the state of public housing in Chicago, and Mick was covering that, as I was calling it, the saga of public housing, because what we saw is, and we continue to see, the Chicago Housing Authority, with a lot of land, is not always using that land to develop that into affordable public housing for folks. And an example of this is, and this is something that we talked about with what's going on in the issue of the ABLA homes, A-B-L-A. The land is essentially vacant. It used to be home to the ABLA housing projects. It's an area that is surrounded by Roosevelt Road, Ashland, 14th Street and Loomis Street, and that is being turned instead of into public housing, which, by the way, we are in a public housing shortage here in the city. That is now officially going to be a new training facility for the Chicago Fire. That was recently signed. It was just about a couple weeks ago now. So this is something that Mick and I talked about again a couple times last year, and now this is officially going to happen. The Chicago Fire, they're going to have a practice facility, a training facility on this land that should have been for public housing. And again, we're in a crisis, right? We need more public housing. We need more affordable housing for residents of Chicago, especially because we displaced so many during periods like the Plan for Transformation, where we knocked down a lot of these housing projects. And the promise was that, well, we will rebuild and we'll get people into housing. That has not really materialized on the scale that we were talking about years ago. So the Chicago Fire gets something out of the deal, and they're going to pay a bunch of money to the city of Chicago and the Chicago Housing Authority, which I guess is good. But still, we need affordable housing in Chicago. So I caught that recently. I think that was in the Sun-Times. And oh, here's something. If that's kind of a bummer, hey, baseball's coming back, and you can get au cheval hamburgers at Wrigley Field. It might cost you like $20, but they're going to be there. Wrigley up in its food game. That's exciting news. I don't know what's going on at guaranteed rates, although I was there last summer. A very nice food and drink selection. It's like going to these games, it's way beyond just hot dogs and cheap beer. It's gourmet food and good times. So if that's your thing, again, you're going to be paying for it, but you're in good shape. We're in good shape for the show this week. Lots to do, so stick around. This is Outside the Loop. I am Mike Steven, raising my $25 hot dog in cheers to you. After a year-long review of the Cook County Juvenile Temporary Detention Center by the nonprofit disability rights group Equip for Equality, a recent report was issued about dangerous and illegal forms of restraint, isolation, and inhumane practices inside the facility. Carlos Ballesteros and Kelly Garcia are reporters for Injustice Watch. That's a local nonpartisan, nonprofit journalism organization that conducts in-depth research exposing institutional failures that obstruct justice and equality. They published a piece on what's going on inside this detention center, and they are here with us today. Carlos and Kelly, welcome to Outside the Loop.
Thanks for having us.
Nice to have you here. So let's talk about, first of all, this facility, this Cook County Juvenile Temporary Detention Center. Carlos, can you just give us a sense here, big picture, who ends up in this facility? What is its purpose?
Yeah, so the Cook County Juvenile Temporary Detention Center is the county's juvenile jail. It holds about 150 youths every day between the ages of 12 and 18. And these teenagers, for the most part, are held pretrial, meaning they've been accused of certain crimes and have been ordered to be held at the juvenile jail as their cases move on in the courts. Some of the teenagers that end up at the juvenile jail are automatically transferred to other facilities run by the state, particularly those who are 17 or 18 years old. Mm-hmm. And don't spend a lot of time at the juvenile jail. So meaning that there is a lot of turnover at the facility, but as the report mentions, a lot of the teenagers that end up there do spend about a month on average every year.
And it's interesting because this is something, I mean, here we're talking about juveniles, we're talking about youth, but jail in general, I know that's been a conversation about how long we're going to hold people after someone has been accused and before you go to trial and what that process is like. So this is an extension of that, but this is talking specifically about children who are committing crimes. So Kelly, you write about specifically what's going on here. I mentioned that there are issues of illegal forms of restraint and isolation, but what are some of the big concerns here about what this report is talking about, what's happening inside this juvenile temporary detention center?
Yeah, so one of the biggest concerns, which has been brought up even before this report came out, is excessive room confinement. So Cook County doesn't necessarily technically practice solitary confinement, but in many cases, especially during disciplinary or even during COVID, when there was isolation periods required, there have been cases in which they have youth confined into separate isolated cells. And so that's been a huge concern for obvious reasons. And there's also another concern about the use of restraint. So in the report, they detail examples of kids who had, you know, their wrists broken, kids who had their face pushed down onto the ground, otherwise known as prone restraint. The report notes that a lot of these uses of restraint are illegal. And so those are definitely some of the two top concerns highlighted in the report. Again, these have been brought up before. Even the chief judge and the superintendent, Leonard Dixon, have acknowledged in the past that room confinement is an issue and that they're working to reduce that.
Yeah, this is there's a lot going on here. I mean, in this facility that is really concerning. And again, this is a juvenile temporary detention center. And this is not like a permanent form of or semi-permanent form of prison. This is kind of like a holding facility. And so there is a school inside the Cook County Juvenile Temporary Detention Center, the Nancy B. Jefferson Alternative School. And the report also focuses on the failure to provide adequate special education for the youth who are incarcerated. Can you explain, Kelly kind of started it there, but explain like what the issue is here, because sometimes we forget, like, these are kids, they need to go to school, and what's going on with that school?
Yeah, so the Nancy B. Jefferson Alternative High School operates inside the temporary detention center. Now, for listeners who want to get an idea of what the detention center looks like, it's on the corner of Roosevelt and Ogden on the near west side. It's like a five-story building, pretty big, pretty massive. And so the school operates inside that same building, which also has the cells and the pods in which the detained teenagers and youth reside. And so the school is operated through CPS, through Chicago Public Schools. Mm-hmm. And so Nancy B. Jefferson, according to the report, is doing a bad job at educating its students with learning disabilities that are detained at the detention center. The school itself, according to the report, does not have enough special education teachers. And that's a particular issue as it relates to the detained student, the detained youths who are in disciplinary pods. And so the report goes into detail as to what these disciplinary pods look like. These pods are specifically for students who have been relegated to be disciplined while they're detained at the detention center. And once you're in this pod, you eat, sleep, and go to school within your own pod. For the kids that are under disciplinary rules in these pods, they're not being serviced with enough special education teachers. And that's a problem because most of the kids that end up in the disciplinary pods have learning disabilities of some sort, according to the report. CPS, when we reached out to them, said that there are no teacher vacancies at the school, basically denying the claims. But the reporters from Equip for Equality, which again has this kind of government authority to investigate abuses against people with disabilities in public facilities, defended their report, saying they saw what they saw. And particularly concerning to them was a practice known as sitting on the wall. Now, I don't know if we should get into this now.
Yeah, well, what is that sitting on the wall practice?
Yeah, so according to the report, kids who were interviewed by Equip for Equality kept talking to them about sitting on the wall, even though there was nothing in the handbook or any of the policies at the detention center that mentioned sitting on the wall. And what the investigators with Equip for Equality were able to find out is that, quote-unquote, sitting on the wall is a disciplinary tactic used by the staff at the detention center against kids who are in need of discipline, according to them. And so essentially what it is a student is relegated to sitting at a desk against the wall in their pod and spending several hours of the day there working on what's called their behavior plan, which essentially is like a worksheet that is the same worksheet every day. Kids reported to Equip for Equality that they don't get any work packets, that they're basically sitting there isolated and, you know, letting time go by. And that kind of practice and isolation has had detrimental effects on the kids. One student who told Equip for Equality they had recently attempted suicide talked about sitting on the wall and how they just saw the clock tick and were kind of losing it. And so the investigators at Equip for Equality called out this practice specifically and said that that Superintendent Dixon, the head of the detention center, should outright ban this practice. Leonard Dixon, in his response to the report, defended the practice, saying that it is not as bad as it was outlined, basically. Because the other claim here is that, from the report, that students can end up being sitting on the wall for up to 15 days.
Wow.
So what that means is, for 15 days, students for like hours of the day are just sitting, doing nothing, essentially. And obviously the Equip for Equality folks call this out and say they should ban it. But in his response, Superintendent Dixon said that 15 days is rare and that most kids don't end up spending that much time and sitting on the wall. But still, the investigators say that's not appropriate, that it's basically not an appropriate setting for kids to be doing that, and that essentially it's, and this is a comprehensive kind of conclusion about the detention center, is that it is making the issues that these kids have worse. You know, a lot of these kids come into the detention center with a lot of emotional issues, with a lot of other issues, a lot of trauma, and what the report is saying is that the detention center is not making any of that better. It is making it worse.
So, okay, I mean, look, this is, again, these are kids. They're coming into this detention center. This is pretrial, so this is a holding facility. And again, it kind of gets back to what we think about the role of incarceration is. Is it to be punitive? Is it to rehabilitate? And certainly when it comes to youth, you would think that we want to help them grow and be better and get better. And so, Kelly, I mean, the process here, and Carlos talked about how this is really impacting kids, because in theory, they're not going to stay at this facility forever, this juvenile temporary detention center on the near west side of Chicago. They're going to move on, but it seems like they're going to be, according to this report, worse off when they leave than when they came in. So in terms of like what happens next, Kelly, what's the plan here? Is there a plan? Are things looking like that they're going to change?
Yeah, no, good question. And as Carlos noted, the report, Equip for Equality, you know, their conclusion was that the solution here is to shut down the institution, right? And to start over with more local, smaller community-based systems. You know, at the moment right now, a lot of these kids, they're going back into the detention center, right? There was one kid, I think, in the report where they were, they told the investigators that they'd been there already four times. So like you said, I mean, you know, we're seeing a cycle here where kids are stuck in this detention center. What's next? Well, the chief judge, you know, in the statement to Injustice Watch, he did say that he is going to start ordering more intensive training on the appropriate use of force and restraint. He's ordering a report on all uses of restraints and forces to his office. The superintendent, Leonard Dixon, did blanket deny a lot of these allegations in the report. But again, it's going to be up to the chief judge. His office is the one that oversees the detention center. And so the pressure is really on him to decide what's next for the future of the detention center. But, you know, this is the fourth report now that's come out about the dangerous and often illegal practices used inside this detention center. So I think a lot of advocates are now pushing for a closure of this detention center and to relocate a lot of these kids that need more rehabilitation than punishment, than punitive solutions. So, you know, I think there's a variety of routes from here, but it's really up to people in power and the chief judge's office to decide what's next.
Well, your reporting is important to get the word out here, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to both of you, because we might not know about this. And this is an issue that is really important. We're talking about kids. We want them to be the best they can be. And obviously, there are a lot of other forces at play here when we talk about certain disinvestment in communities and other forces at play when we talk about how kids get to this point. But when they're here, how do we meet them where they're at and get them to a better place? And that's ultimately the big question here. But this reporting is important. This report is important. And we should go to injusticewatch.org, injusticewatch.org, to read what Carlos Ballesteros and Kelly Garcia, reporters at Injustice Watch, have put together. Thank you both for talking to us about this issue, guys. And thanks for your reporting, and keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
I came across a recent Tribune article that talks about a familiar issue here in Chicago, and that is police torture. And we have by now heard about and discussed the former CPD detective John Burge and his legacy of torturing individuals into confessing to crimes that they did not commit over about a 20-year period here in Chicago. And he was not the only one. There is another detective, former CPD detective, Criston Cato, who is under scrutiny right now. They're trying to bring him to trial, it looks like, and he's married to a Cook County judge, so there's a conflict of interest there. But it got me thinking about, again, our justice system, but also specifically about race and the justice system. And it reminded me of a conversation that I had about 3 years ago now, in June of 2020, pretty much in the week after George Floyd was killed. I spoke with, on this show, Charlene Grace, who's the executive director of the Chicago Community Bond Fund, and Aislinn Pulley, the co-executive director of the Chicago Torture Justice Project. I'm going to air that conversation on the show today, and this starts off with Aislinn telling us about the Chicago Torture Justice Project and the necessity for it. So right now, let's rewind to June of 2020.
Well, the Chicago Torture Justice Center was born out of the reparations ordinance for survivors of police torture that was passed in May of 2015. And that was a culmination of decades of fight by survivors who had been tortured by John Burge, as well as other police officers, their family members, and attorneys. And what happened was that after Burge was convicted of lying under oath and obstruction of justice, he was given about 4 years for his sentence. And the community, including survivors, felt like that was a paltry response to the enormity of damage and trauma that had been enacted on not just the survivors, but their family members and community. And so an exhibition was called. And in that exhibition, they asked people to imagine what reparations could look like. And Joey Mogul, an attorney with the People's Law Office and one of the main attorneys who had been representing torture survivors up to that point, submitted what she knows best, which is the law, and was inspired by another civil rights attorney, Standish Willis, and submitted a reparations ordinance. The community responded and said, let's make this happen. Let's make this real. And the community organized and fought to have the reparations ordinance entered into city council. It was then basically delayed in city council for about a year until Rahm Emanuel was forced into a runoff. And then we waged a targeted campaign to force him into signing it. And it was unanimously approved by city council on May 5th, 2015, making Chicago the first municipality in the country to pass a reparations ordinance for survivors of police torture.
I think that's, again, worth repeating. Chicago, the first city to provide reparations to those harmed by racially motivated police violence. And, you know, 2015 seems like forever ago, especially these days and the times that we're living in right now. But, you know, I think that ordinance is very important. Again, specifically looking at that period from like about 1972 to 1991, when we talk about Commander John Burge of the Chicago Police Department. But we think about protesting. Protesting is on our minds this week. That is an example of protesting, of organizing, of people getting together to further the conversation and to get something done, to affect change. And I feel like, especially this week, I feel like at times there has been this, oh boy, these protesters are, you know, it's a pain in the butt. And certainly we don't want to confuse those with the looters and the violence, but we're talking about peaceful protests here. But what you're speaking of, Aislinn, is an example of how protesting and organizing really works.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think there's a few things that I'd like to say just regarding the construct of peaceful protests versus violent looters. And I think that framing creates a binary that's false. What we've actually seen is a consequence of the massive armed response to people exercising our constitutional rights to protest. What we saw last Saturday was over 20,000 people gathering downtown, both on foot as well as in car caravans, ready to exercise our constitutional rights to petition the government, air our grievances, and demand that the extrajudicial murdering of Black people be ended, and the defunding of police, not only in Chicago, but across the country. What we were met with were armed police officers, SWAT teams, and the police began tear gassing people and beating people and arresting people as early as 2:30. And then CPD and the city, you know, and it's unclear who exactly made the call, made the choice to raise up the bridges. There was no access to public transit. Both the CTA and the Metro were shut down and people were trapped. So that method of response by the state is an antagonistic, violent response. And the consequence of that is a result of that response. People were beat. People were pepper sprayed. There were guns pulled on children. Children were arrested. We had mothers who had to witness their young children. There was a special needs person who was arrested. That violence precipitated what we've seen. And that's a consequence of the continued attempts at repressing our constitutional rights to demand equal treatment in this country. And when we obfuscate that, then it erases the true dynamics on the ground. And all throughout this week, we've seen police brutally beat people. We've had people in the hospital. We had one person who went to the ER twice because of the concussion. We had two other people who lost consciousness who were beaten. And this is all across the city. This is on the north side. This is on the south side. This is on the west side. So the response by the police and the response by the mayor has been antagonistic and violent. And that's where we need to focus. That is going to just further incite people.
And Charlene, again, going back to you, you know, we're talking about how our justice system works, how our legal system works. And I've had this conversation before on this program, but I think, you know, what you do is an example of just how deep, when we talk about institutionalized racism, how many layers this entails. I mean, certainly, I think that is reflective in what you do. This is just one little facet of a bigger institution that is affected by systemic racism.
That is absolutely correct. So I think to sort of build on the points that Aislinn made before the break, the very way that crime functions and the way the criminal legal system functions in this country is really and has always been a form of racialized social control. So policing developed from both slave patrols and from in northern cities, patrols that were meant to control European immigrants who weren't yet considered white at the time and were viewed as less able to manage their own well-being in this new country that was forming. And so that is the legacy. It's always been part of the institution of policing. What is considered a crime is always been racialized. The drug war is a perfect example of that. The way people enter the criminal legal system is through policing. We police different neighborhoods differently based on the race and economic status of who lives in those neighborhoods. And so one of the takeaways that I'd like to offer listeners today is to think critically about the whole idea of what crime is and when and how we respond to different kinds of harm, or as you were talking about earlier, Aislinn, to different kinds of violence.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when we think about, again, what happened this week, there were videos online on Twitter of black folks saying to white people who were looting and graffitiing and all this stuff, they were telling them, hey, stop, because you're not the ones that are going to be arrested for this. The assumption is going to be that us black folks are guilty of the crime, even though we didn't do it. And certainly that is what you're talking about how all of this has played out, the assumption of who is the criminal and how we treat certain groups, especially African Americans. And, you know, this kind of segues into the need for an organization like Black Lives Matter. And Aislinn, you are the founder of the Chicago chapter of Black Lives Matter. And I think it's important to note that because your group has been working continuously, not just in the wake of what happened with George Floyd, but again, trying to eliminate systemic racism. And there is, boy, I mean, there's a need for this organization. And I know that sometimes what I hear from people in some, you know, in my circles of, oh, all lives matter. Well, yeah, we know that, but we have to say that Black Lives Matter because, to Charlene's point, that's not how society's been operating.
Yeah, I would like to also just say that the Chicago chapter of Black Lives Matter very, very intentionally works in collaboration with a plethora of other groups who have been organizing for a while or who have been just created. Our orientation to the work is that it's not one organization that's going to bring about change and is going to end police killings. It's going to take a concerted effort of all of us. And there are people who, you know, may feel comfortable in a different type of organization or in a different type of group. And that's great. We want to encourage people to explore and flex their muscles, figure out where they are best aligned. The most important thing is to get together with other like-minded people and do the work. There is so much need. There is so much need. So we definitely focus on policing, and specifically working with families whose loved ones have been killed by policing, as well as survivors of police torture, as well as community members, because Chicago has the most police per 100,000 people in the country. So the enormity of the crisis of policing is felt so acutely by Black Chicagoans, for sure, but it is felt throughout the city. And so we work with anyone who is ready to be aligned with our politics and with our beliefs. But we also encourage people who, for whatever reasons, don't want to join BLM, join something else, get involved. There's a lot of discussion around ownership of the name of BLM, and we take the position that Black Lives Matter is owned by the people. It's owned by the people who are protesting, and we want formations to spring up. There's brilliance being ignored, and we want that brilliance exercised. We are learning every day. We all can play a part in transforming this society.
You know, part of all of this, I think, is examining the white power structure that exists across our institutions, like politics, the economy, justice, education. And I think this can be really uncomfortable, but it's necessary for that uncomfortable feeling to exist and to live in that and sort of be able to deconstruct that. Charlene, I just wanted to ask you about that in terms of examining the structures that exist and thinking about how we deconstruct it. I mean, I would think one of the first things we have to acknowledge is that this is how it is and this is how it's been set up.
That's exactly right. And as a white person who myself, when I was growing up in rural central Missouri, I thought the best thing we could do was not see color. And it wasn't until I moved to Chicago for college and decided to invest in the city and stay here and build community here that I was given the chance to learn that we can't do that, because that's not the reality that we live in. And in order to effectively address the oppression and repression that we have in the United States and across the world, we need to be honest about what it is. And I, one of the things that has brought me comfort as a white person, constantly learning and trying to grow and commit to working for racial justice, is the knowledge that it's not an individual failing to come in with misunderstandings and to mess up and to make mistakes. It is a product of the environment that we're raised in. And what anti-racism work requires of us is not that we are perfect, but that we are committed to learning and growing and to fighting white supremacy and to supporting Black liberation and to supporting the work that people impacted by it are directing us to do and pointing out and saying where the needs are.
Yeah, and Aislinn, when we talk about that sort of deconstruction of white supremacy in our society and white power structures, I know that that's something that activists have been thinking about and advocating for. It's not easy, and like I said, it's uncomfortable, but it really is, I think, the way I see it, I mean, it's a necessary step into getting to progress. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in this country, as Charlene explained, with the origins of policing, the hegemonic belief system that justified creating slave patrols and up north a lot of privatized policing units in order to patrol neighborhoods was also, both of them were also linked to creating racial capitalism, creating white supremacy in order to justify the extreme inequity that is a consequence of capitalism. So it's important that we also include within our analysis of racial justice the larger political systems that also are at play and necessitate white supremacy. So when we break down white supremacy, we're also revealing the other mechanisms at play, which is capitalism. And then we have to look at imperialism and have a deeper discussion on how society has been structured, and who are the people who are benefiting from this? Because we know, you know, in Chicago, Chicago's one of the most segregated cities in the country, if not the most. But we also know that there is poverty in places in the country, not especially Chicago, but certainly other places in the country where white poverty is a real thing, right? And so we have to be able to also have a class analysis and understand how is racism useful for capitalism and where and how is it showing up?
Well, this is really an important conversation that will continue, and we have to confront the issue of systemic racism in our society, and we've got to do it now. I mean, boy, we should have done this a long time ago, and we have. We've been working on this for a while, but as a society, I think the work really needs to step up, and I really appreciate both of what you do, your organizations. Again, Charlene Grace is the executive director of the Chicago Community Bond Fund, and Aislinn Pulley is the co-executive director of the Chicago Torture Justice Center and founder of the Chicago chapter of Black Lives Matter. Go online, check out chicagobond.org and chicagotorturejustice.org. Charlene and Aislinn, thank you so much for talking to us today here on Outside the Loop, and please continue your great work.
Thank you. It's an honor.
Thanks for having us.
And that will do it. Outside the Loop show number 858 is done. Thank you, as always, for listening to the show. I appreciate it. I appreciate Bob Ferguson for all of his engineering help today. Have a wonderful week. I'll talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.